The beginning is the time for taking another attempt at readapting a classic sci-fi novel to this big screen. For every new version of an adaptation of this famed book, we have to wonder, is it really time to do this twice? I don't know, let's see. That was kind of a weird start. I was trying to read the first chapter of this famous book as a way to do this opening, but I think this is going to be quite an awkward start for what is essentially our new episode of Nothing New. So
there is tale of a planet that is full of a great thing called podcasts.
Good. That's good. I like that. Keep going.
And he who rules the podcasts rules the world.
There it is. Like, share, and subscribe. Hello, welcome to a new episode of Nothing New, a remake podcast. I am one of your hosts, Justin Keyson, and along with me, as always, is...
I am Andrew Lindy. You know, sometimes the way that we start this can be a little bit spicy, you know what I mean?
There we go. Okay. There we go.
Gotta fall back on a pun when you can.
You know, it's like, I didn't know what impression to do on this one, and I kind of felt like, I don't want to do that.
You didn't want to do the voice.
Yeah, I kind of didn't want to do the voice either. I was just like, what's a different route? And I realized this is one of those and went, I should have planned this a little stronger. Regardless, welcome to a new episode. If you haven't figured out, I don't know how you figured it out, short of already downloading the episode, we will be talking about... an adaptation of a very, very famous sci-fi novel, and epic in scope, infamous for being particularly, how do I put it, strong material and very very thick material, as someone might even say. So we are talking about the 1984 film Dune.
And the 2021 Dune Part 1?
Right.
Question mark?
So I just wanted to be clear. I've only seen the first hour of the 1984 film.
Oh, okay.
So we're going to be... I got to be authentic. I got to be real. So, and like, oh, I'm just... Boy. I'm kidding. I did see through the whole film. So I did see
I thought so. Well, we'll get more into that in a moment. We had to... have with us someone who could really lead us through the desert dunes of Arrakis and not get eaten by a sandworm.
Yeah.
So we brought a very special guest with us on today's episode. Please welcome Danny Montooth of Perception Studios. How you doing, Danny?
Hi. Pretty good. I'm very excited to teach you to walk without rhythm. We're gonna do this. We're gonna make it out alive. It's gonna be fine.
Did you say website? Did you say Danny Muad'Dib? Is that what I heard? Was that?
That's only fitting, I think. But yes, I think we will get into that, the intrigue of a part one, part two situation when we get to our second half of our episode.
Mm-hmm.
But Justin, can I just say, very, very reminiscent of our It. Part one troubles.
Absolutely. No, I was thinking of that. Whereas we part one came out, we saw the theatrical film, which was part one. We went to go see, of course, It on the TV miniseries. It then realizing, oh wait, right, that's the whole book. So we are, by proxy of doing the original adaptation, we are in fact actually seeing stuff that won't be addressed in the remake redo of the story. So you know, again, we'll see what happens when Dune Part 2 comes out. And you know, for the record, we haven't done anything with It Part 2, so
I don't, that's the spoiler alert, I don't think we will. I think it's done.
I don't think we'll put that will to either. Bed. Yeah, so I, you know, so if you really, I will say again, you know, I'll pump ahead, if you really want us to talk about Dune Part 2, guaranteed, there is a way, but I won't reveal it until like after our little break.
But let us begin with David Lynch's Dune from 1984. And I have to ask, Danny, how did you first see that film?
Okay, so I am the youngest of four, and so basically my oldest my older brother, my only brother, but the oldest of the four of us, determined everything that I ever watched or listened to as a child because he was in control of the TV. So I saw Dune for the first time probably when I was like 7 or 8 or something like that. I didn't know what the hell I was watching. I knew it was gorgeous. I knew I liked it. I watched it over and over and over again. And then somewhere around middle school where I read the book, went back and watched that movie, and I was like, what the fuck happened? Like, can I?
Oh, you can curse. Go ahead.
Okay, great. Thank you. Yeah, so it was weird because it's like I both deeply love and deeply hate the 84 Dune. Like and at like, you know, maximum levels on both sides of it. Like there's so much to love about it and there's so much to be furious about with that film. So I sit happily in the middle. I still rewatch it probably once a year. It's up there with my favorite movies of all time, but I still kind of hate it, and I'll never get over either side. It's great.
Wow. Oh my goodness, that's perfect. Andrew,
that's so. I mean, Justin, I have to say that's so interesting because I feel like every, you know, once in a while you bring up that your brother introduced you to a film.
True. Yes.
And I think that is such a lovely way. That's such like a family, it's passing down the knowledge in a way.
Oh no, it's definitely kind of like, yeah, you're right. It's definitely like, oh, it is time. And so it's, you
know. even if it's unintentional, even if it's just like, yeah, that's just what they watched. It's like, yeah, they're just sharing what they weirdly love with you.
Yeah. And I feel like something like a Dune is obviously kind of one of those movies where it's like, it clearly affected someone at the right age. And if you do want to just sort of share that experience, you share a Dune, you share a Star Wars, or you share a Raiders and et cetera. I will say, so Dune is one of those movies, for me, I've always knew about Dune, but I also didn't know if I should ever watch Dune. I saw it as a kid when I went to go rent movies, and every time I walked by it in the sci-fi section, I looked at it and I'm like, I should rent that, right? Like, it looks like something I'd be into because I liked, you know, the sci-fi, you know, genre. I like sci-fi 80 movies, and yet something about it always told me go like to walk away from it. And I don't know what it was. My brother never saw it, so this is actually one of those rare cases he couldn't influence me one way or another. So I just knew about Dune as a kid because I saw the cover art and went, that looks neat, but then not enough for me to go and rent it. And never was a cable staple until finally, like, I think at some point, like, Sci-Fi Channel was just airing it. And I'm like, sure, okay, I'll try it now. And this was before their miniseries that they did, so I think they were just, we have the rights to Dune, just air Dune on a Saturday afternoon. And
do you know if you saw the theatrical cut or the final cut?
This is okay, good point. So this was in fact the infamous TV cut.
Okay.
Yeah, the one that Lynch took his name off of. And
yes, the Alan Smithy.
The Alan Smithy. And boy, whoa, that was rough. Like it did the opening sequence by doing all this like concept art to try to explain everything. Let me tell you, that was a big wall to try to climb for me to kind of really sit through it. So I was like, okay, how long is this? You know, so I finally didn't really, truthfully, I will say this, like, a couple days ago was my first real proper attempt at, like, okay, I'm just going to sit through the Lynch film beginning to end. So this is actually the first time I really sat through it was this week.
Wow.
Congratulations.
Wow. Thank you.
You made it.
Yeah.
Proud of you.
Yeah. Thanks.
I will say, yeah, I feel like my experience very similar to Justin. I never saw it. I never was really super into David Lynch, but a few years back I was like, oh, let me start watching, I just want to watch all of one director's movies. So I would be like, okay, what can I get from David Lynch right now? And so I watched like Mulholland Drive and some of those others, but I never got to Dune. So this is my first time watching it for the purpose of this podcast.
Andrew, here's a question then, like, because I feel like I started doing the similar thing, and I also kind of didn't really do Dune, even in my kind of Lynch watch. And is it because we heard of the reputation of the film that it didn't feel like we were really going to watch a David Lynch movie the same way we were going to watch, like, Blue Velvet or...
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I definitely think that's it. And the other weird thing is I never can quite get into Twin Peaks. So it's not that I especially love David Lynch and was like, oh, I can't watch this thing that isn't ultra David Lynch. Mm-hmm. I was just kind of like, well, I'll stick with the more mainstream, the more mainline David Lynch things.
Yeah. You wouldn't use the word mainstream with David Lynch.
yeah.
Mainline's a good way of you. Is the correct word. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. But definitely, yeah, just somehow, I mean, and I still haven't even watched, like, The Straight Story, but I think that's in that same zone of, like, this isn't what you want in a David Lynch movie.
Yeah.
You know, when I was like, I'm watching David Lynch movies, I'm like, yeah, I want the weird stuff. I want Eraserhead.
Yeah. No, I get you. Yeah, no, for sure. Lost Highway and such. I get you.
Yes. Definitely. But yeah, so this was my first time watching Dune, and I don't even think I ever really put together, watching it now, it just is so apparent that it was, you know, because it was on the heels of Star Wars, I think it was kind of like, you know, oh, like, we can be another Star Wars. Like, it was right there in that zone of that same kind of space, like a big space story. Mm-hmm. Something really, but it was also more of a... it's also more of a fantasy in that way that Star Wars is kind of a fantasy.
Right.
It's almost as if Star Wars took a shit ton from Dune and then made a movie
about it. Yeah, I think we need to address that elephant in the room very early in this discussion because it's Dune was a book first before Star Wars was even an idea. So,
yep. 1965.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting to see, to just... finally get to that now and be like, oh, I can see all of this is all mixed together here, huh?
I will say I'm not one of those Dune fans who's gonna like cram it down and say like all of Star Wars is stolen from Dune. He stole from literally everybody.
Yeah.
But a lot of like the big broad strokes of the visuals and the setting and the Jedi shit is pretty much all Dune.
Yeah.
And the rest of it is Japanese cinema.
But, right. 100%. I mean, literally, your hero is literally living on a desert planet. I mean, like, that's like a big one right there. And
it's very, he's the chosen one. It follows like a lot of,
So here's the thing, like, it's funny, Danny, you kind of brought up like your feelings of the film is that you both love the film, but also kind of hate the film. At the same time.
So much.
And it's so funny because the only other big fan of Dune I knew in my life was a former coworker of mine who said the same exact thing. It's actually one of his... He's a fantastic artist, and he... all his artwork is very Dune, very heavy metal inspired, like Mobius-style work. And he tells me the same thing, and I just find that fascinating that, like... I was thinking of him when I was watching it for the first time, and I went, this movie looks amazing. You know, like top to bottom visually in terms of costumes and set design and cinematography and Lynch being very Lynch in certain montage sequences. But man, oh man, has it become a massive narrative mess. Like,
yeah.
I would say the moment they had to escape and go to the desert to meet the Fremen, the movie becomes a gigantic narrative mess.
Oh, for sure.
You know, sure. And
it really, you know, utilizes the like montage time passing of like, and then things happened.
Yeah. Oh gosh. Yes. Yeah. And I hate to use this comparison. The only other time I've seen someone try to do that and fail utterly is Lynch. I'm sorry. I'm going to put your name next to this filmmaker's other, The Last Airbender.
Oof. Oh. Ouch. Ouch. I don't think Dune is that bad.
It's not that bad. No, no. I don't think it's not that bad. I want that to be 100% clear. But
yeah.
Shyamalan did a very similar kind of try to rush the story in the way that I only saw in this and I will be fair, in this edit of the film. you know. Ooh,
I would like to add that this the same feeling there is that Shyamalan wasn't a fan of the show.
Right.
And similarly, Lynch didn't really give a shit about Dune. Although I do firmly believe he tried his best.
I agree.
Which I don't think Shyamalan did.
I also agree.
Yeah, I do think it has been on the record that David Lynch has said that this is his like one disappointment, but I think he means that in the way of he did try. Like he just knew that what he put out was not what he could have had, and then he didn't have final edit.
Yeah,
he didn't have final edit, and producers would step in and tell him no to a bunch of the stuff that he was trying to accomplish. And there's stuff that got accomplished that never got utilized either. So that's why that whole last quarter of the film is such a rockin' mess. It's not his fault. That's what sucks. It's like, I feel like if he was allowed to do everything he wanted, it still would have been weird as shit and a little bit off, but it probably would have been closer to the story that we all wanted to see.
I 100% agree with that, because I feel like Lynch... Here's my deal. You hired David Lynch to be David Lynch, right? And that was sort of, you know, the tract of what you want from that, you know, director. Even though this is technically his third movie, you know, you watch at least The Elephant Man, you go, okay, I get that vibe would fit with Herbert's book. So, okay, fine, go for it. But then it's a science fiction movie. It's an action. There's some action in it. And everybody's still chasing the Star Wars, you know, dragon to a certain degree.
Yeah.
And studios are always just going to be very myopic and go like, okay, so we just need this to be a 2-hour sci-fi adventure film. And Lynch is like, it's a little bit more than that. And because of that, yeah, it suffers greatly. I think it's also one of those showcases where it's like, can David work within the studio system? And as of at least 1980s, the answer is a clear, gigantic no. Especially with a movie as big as this, you know. So, yeah. But I do appreciate when I watched the movie, I went, oh, but he's trying so hard to sneak in there. You know? Like, I see Lynch in there. I do see him. It's just, that third act, is all over the place. And it's such a shame, you know?
I want to mention, so talking about Lynch, like very Lynch things, David Lynch things, I mean, this the opening of kind of like a disembodied, you know, floating head of a woman telling you something is very Lynch.
It's also very similar to the book, actually. That's one of those weird things of like, oh, this checks out. Like, this is okay. Nice. Yeah. Because every chapter... go ahead.
No, go ahead. The book, what was it in the book?
So every chapter in the book opens with either like a segment from histories. So basically these histories are being pulled from the future of the story that you're currently reading. Mm-hmm. So it opens with Irulan, much like the film, basically saying, you know, a beginning is a very delicate time. Like all of that information is in there at the top, at the open. But then other chapters will have excerpts from current religious texts or, you know, old interviews with people who knew Paul when he was younger or, you know, like, and this is what they said about the fate of the traitor and blah, blah, blah. So like every chapter would give you a little bit of world building, a little bit of like future sight. It basically tells you what's going to happen before it happens. So each chapter is you waiting for these things to unfold. It's a very interesting way to build tension in a narrative. And I feel like Lynch actually kind of captured that pretty well and then overdid it, but I think he did a good job.
That's really fascinating to hear that, honestly, because I never read the book, but that sounds like a really, I think the thing that you would, the most intriguing idea you told is the idea that it's an excerpt of someone from the future talking about Paul's past as like historical fact. I'm like, now that's kind of cool. And I don't think I've seen that. It definitely wasn't utilized in this film. It wasn't utilized, I guess, spoiler, it's not going to be utilized in the 2021 movie. And my vague memory of the Sci-Fi Channel miniseries, I don't believe it was there either. But that sounds like an interesting narrative device. It works great, I'm assuming, as you probably confirmed it. It sounds like it works great in the narrative as a way to, of the book, as a way to kind of keep giving us information about the world they've created, because I think that's what daunts people about Dune, even not just filmmakers, people who want to start the story. There's so much to pack in.
Oh, for sure.
To learn.
Especially book one. Book one is total info dump. Like there's a, oh, Hot tip, there's a glossary at the back, everybody. So if you start reading Dune, you know what the fuck they're saying. Just flip to the back of the book. It'll tell you. Because I didn't know that was there until I was done reading the whole damn thing. Because I'm not a guy who flips to the back of the book. Like, I'm just like, I don't want anything to be spoiled. And then I was just like, oh, that's what that means. Oh, so utilize that and you'll be fine. And yeah.
They should have done like a like pop-up video with the new Dune.
There it is. There it is. Actually,
Sandwalk.
But I want to mention the other thing that really stuck out to me is right at the beginning, very like, oh, you're watching a David Lynch movie, is the space navigator? I don't know what that thing was called. The giant
guild navigator, yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
That giant worm-looking thing, but it was more like an insect. And
you want some spoilers? You want some spoilers?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do it.
So that guild navigator is actually a human being, or at least he used to be. But so guild navigators, you don't actually see one in the flesh until book two in Dune Messiah. So they're described as sort of fish-like, floating in a vat of spice. So that design was fucking boss for me as a kid. I was like, oh my god, they nailed it. He's huge for no fucking reason, but other than that, it's pretty spot on, because it's like, so the guild navigators, they mention it in both films, but they require the spice in order to do the mental math to plot courses through folding space, because otherwise you end up in a star, kind of similar to like Star Wars hyperspace, right? It's like, if you don't plot on the right course, you go through a planet. So that's why the spice is so essential, because they can no longer use the thinking machines that they used to use to do this, because the thinking machines rose up and there was a whole fucking war. So those times are past, which is why all the machines now are very simple. You got simple computers, and due to shields, that's why we're using knives and swords and stuff again. It's a whole thing. I love this universe.
I do have to say, I very much enjoy we're in the future. We're in the year like 10,000 or something.
Yeah.
We're not really on Earth. These are just, I don't know where these planets are. And yet it is very much like we've also gone back in time to like a medieval system of living. Yes. And that kind of weird mix, I'm like, okay, I can get into that. That's a little more interesting to me than just, it's the future, we all have lasers now.
Lasers are dangerous now, which I love. Because I like that he acknowledges, of course, that technology would advance. Now, how do I nerf it for this story? So it's not just like hit a button, everybody dies. There's consequences anytime you do anything in this universe. Like, I'm a sucker for good world building, and Frank Herbert is a god. He's such a good job.
The guild navigator is such a David Lynch creature. Like, this is, if you've seen, Eraserhead and Elephant Man, like, these are, he's building to this idea of like what kind of thing can he show you that will be gross, but also he's not doing it to scare you. Like, he's doing it like, as this is a, hey, this is a little creature, take a look at it. And even though it's gross, check it out. Like, the way that there are certain, the guild navigator comes up a couple of times in the film. And at one point, we see them making the wormhole or something, and just the camera just zooms in on its weird little mouth.
I did sort of hate the illustration of how they folded space, because they had him sort of like magically do it, right? Doesn't he shoot a beam or something?
Yeah.
That's not how that works, man. He just thinks about it, figures it out, and then hits some fucking buttons, or tells other people to hit some buttons. But that's pretty much it. He doesn't get like superpowers outside of being able to see through time and space, which is pretty boss.
But, I can't do that, so that's cool.
So now that we've talked about the most important character, the guild navigator, let's go to everybody else.
No. Andrew, we got 3 more hours to talk about the guild navigator. We ain't done yet. No, of course. And I'm just going to go, let's go straight to Maudeep himself. Paul. Yeah, let's talk about Paul Atreides.
Sure.
Kyle MacLachlan. And
about 30 years old, playing 17.
He was 25 when he shot the film. So it's this weird, I was telling this to my roommate, because we were watching it together, and I'm actually a fairly decent Twin Peaks fan, personally. So, and so was he, and we were watching this movie and realizing, like, wow, he's such a baby in this film. But also, like, I don't buy him as a 17-year-old. You know? Like, I don't buy him as a teenager. He definitely looks like he's, like, he's probably around Hamill's age, when Hamill did Star Wars. And it's very odd. I will, this is a personal opinion, I don't know if you two will share this, but I feel when he's, the first hour of the movie when he's Paul Atreides, I had a hard time buying him as, like, more of a naive, you know, idealistic kind of character that he was. And it's not like I thought he was bad, I just didn't really, kind of really wasn't vibing with it. It was like, it was fine. I found him more interesting when he started leading and embracing his prophecy side in the second half of the movie. And I was like, in a weird way, I feel like Kyle MacLachlan is a better fit playing an eccentric than playing kind of the every kid, the every guy. And I think that's just probably my personal perception of MacLachlan, because I'm so used to playing eccentrics from this point out, you know, whether it be Agent Coop or that weird guy in How I Met Your Mother, you know, something like that.
The captain, of course.
The captain, exactly. Thank you. So that's my personal feeling on MacLachlan. How about you two?
Oh, well, I mean, anytime he shows up in something, I'm like, oh, cool, Kyle MacLachlan's in this. he's just a real pleasure to see. And yeah, it is really wild to see him so young. I just don't, you know, but still not young enough to be a teen. They do have to, because of the way that this movie is structured, I feel like they are leaning more on that second half than on the first. It that fits in that way. Otherwise they'd have to do the 90s Little Women and cast two people as Paul, and that would just be a little much.
They keep going with this series, they're gonna have to. But I feel like Kyle MacLachlan, I mean, again, similarly, I love that man. I'll see him in anything. I think he's so much fun. Of him being, you know, outaged, I think he did a great job with the character. Because I don't know if Paul's ever meant to be particularly naive. Like,
That's fair.
Because he's been trained his whole life, both as a Mentat, as a Bene Gesserit, as a Duke. Like, he's going to, like, he knows as a kid he's going to fill the shoes of his father. Mm-hmm. So, and he's coddled, so he's a bit of a brat. Like, he's he's essentially an asshole kid who's being trained from all sides to lead for different things and for different reasons. So it's like, I think the only thing he's actually, like, sort of naive about is the lengths at which enemies will go to get to him and his ilk, you know? But yeah, also same. I like him as weird Mon Deep better than just cheerful little Paul. Like,
so moving on from Kyle, I think it's only fair we just stayed with the family Atreides and go to Jorgen Pronchow? Is that how you pronounce his name? Anyone?
I believe so.
No idea.
As Duke Leto Atreides, what did you folks think of him?
That was great.
Great. I think just speaking to not just his performance, but the kind of structure of Dune in general, just from these two films, and especially starting here, is I really like that Leto is a supportive father. Like, he just is very, like, I there's no meanness in him. He is like, I love my son. My son is perfect, and I'm gonna love him no matter what. It's not like I feel like some of these kinds of movies lean into, like, oh, I have big expectations of you, and if you don't reach them, I'm never gonna forgive you. Mm-hmm. And you really don't get that from Leto at all. And this Procknow's performance just carries that.
He's strong but not cruel, and an excellent leader, and he's supposed to be, and that's why he's such a threat to the Emperor as a character, because he is beloved by the entire Landsraad. So, like, he's got to be, like, lovable, and that's what that whole, like, spice now, scene is, like, the harvester scene is all about.
Clarification on what the Landsraad is.
Sure. Okay. So think of the Landsraad as, like, the UN of planets, right? So we mentioned it's basically a feudal system. So everybody's in charge of a different planet. Different houses are in charge of different planets or systems or whatever. And so the Landsraad is the collection of all of them. So it's like they would gather up and, you know, enact laws and all of that stuff. So that's sort of the government, right? And though the emperor is in charge, if any of these houses get too powerful, they become a threat to the emperor, which is what was happening with the Atreides. The Atreides were so good at leading and so loved by all the people, even other houses, that they have loyalty and alliance kind of all over the place. And the emperor's like, nah, 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 fuck that. I'm gonna give you Arrakis and then betray you and try to destroy your house from the inside. So that's the impetus for all this. Basically, because Leto is kind, he's fucked.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I think that's such a fascinating structure. It's almost, you know, like Shakespearean in nature. Mm-hmm. Of, I mean, this movie especially, it focuses in, and really we only hear about the two houses, Atreides and Harkonnen. Mm-hmm. And then we have the emperor. And in fact, the movie begins with the guild navigator comes to the emperor and is like, hey, we're sensing some problems. And also, we know you have a secret. So tell us your secret and we'll tell you the problem. Like, it's kind of feels very much like a, to me, just like a Shakespeare moment. Like, of here's the setup of this, you know, two countries, you know, they cannot stand each other. And what will it take to provoke them into war?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Right.
100%.
I just thought was like, I was like, wow, this is not really what I thought it was at all. Not that I thought it was anything in particular, but I was just kind of like, oh, this is a lot more of like a, almost like a classic story structure rather than any kind of like, oh, we're in space, we can do space things.
Right. Yeah, it's definitely more like a political meditation than it is like a swashbuckling space adventure, for sure. Mm-hmm. I will say, though, both films managed to ignore the sort of, not necessarily darker side of Leto, but he's still a leader, he still has responsibilities, and he's still very, very smart. So there's a sort of speech that happens in the book that doesn't happen in either film, and I wish that both of them did it, where he basically takes Paul aside and he just says, I'm paraphrasing, basically like, hey, if you have to be a tyrant to keep our banner flying, be a tyrant.
Ooh.
And it's like super important to Paul's development, and both have sort of shied away because you want that noble death of Leto.
Right.
And he means it in the best way. It's basically like, hey, protect your family, protect the house so that you can in turn protect the people. But yeah, it's like, if you got to be ruthless, be ruthless.
That's interesting. Also, yeah. That's very interesting. And I can see how that would lead into where Paul gets to, you know, where Paul gets to at the end of the, at least in this movie specifically. So, interesting.
Oh, man.
That would have been...
The end of this movie is one of the worst things ever. It makes me so mad.
We'll get to that.
But, yeah, we will.
So, okay, I don't want to... It's a huge cast. I'm just going to hit on two other important characters before... Mm. We move on, because it's big, and everyone plays a big part, but I want to talk about Lady Jessica next.
Yeah!
Francesca Annis, who I thought was kind of great in this, to be honest. I thought she was pretty great. But I don't know, how about you two? What else can you guys kind of add to that thought? I don't know what else to say about her. I think, oh, she's really good in this, so I don't know.
I love her. She nailed it. She's perfect.
What about it that she nailed?
So Jessica she's one of these characters who is stuck between worlds. She has to serve both the Bene Gesserit and also Leto, whom she loves, but doesn't have the same power as a true lady, like a lady of the house might, because they never got married. And she wants to take care of her son, but also because she had a son, she is responsible for his fate and accidentally, like, so she chose to have a son because of her love for Duke Leto, because Leto wanted an heir. But in having a son, she's betrayed the Bene Gesserit. Because they're only supposed to have girls to basically further their order and all of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so she is this woman like torn between two to three worlds at any given time. And she manages to do it with like grace, expertise. And she's one of the most badass characters in the books, period.
Right.
Cause she's such like, but she allows herself to feel, she has these emotions. She's able to handle it all. And I think that she's also a bear. Mother, she's just like a super, I don't know, I fucking love her. Jessica is one of my favorite characters, and I think you pick up on all of those emotions throughout the film, which is pretty cool. How much is going on in her brain?
Awesome.
A side note about, like you say, as much as going on in her brain, this movie does make a big use of, we kind of zoom in on a character and we hear their thoughts for like a minute.
Yes, that is exactly like the book.
Yeah, I can only imagine that is something in the book that is kind of pulled off a little more.
Yes. Very successful on the page. Very annoying on the screen.
On the screen, it's just kind of like, oh, we're just, everybody's thoughts are out there, huh?
I think I've read that, I'm not sure how, if this is true, Danny, so you can, if you know, please go ahead and correct it, but I was reading that, like, those narrations were another set of another kind of situation with trying to shorten the film.
Oh, really?
I was reading it somewhere on Wiki that's those elements were included to kind of help with the pacing of the film, or just get the information across in the 2 hour time span that Lynch was required to do. And I will say that, like, okay, so you're telling me those are definitely in the book?
Oh yeah, okay. Yeah, 100%. So every conversation is a chess game in this book. So okay. It's like you've got everyone has their own wants, their own desires, and they're all trying to navigate each other in this very political sense. And so it's, and also like understanding the internal monologue of people reacting to Paul, everyone he encounters. It's like it's so much, but it's also so important to understand like the surface level. It's like, hey, we're all smiles right now, but I've just done a hand signal that means this, but I'm actually thinking this. And if he picked up on that, that means that we're both in like on the same page, which means we can then overtake the situation. You're like, holy fuck! Like, every scene is like that. Like no sentence is wasted on the page. There's so much.
Which I'm like, that's great for a book.
Exactly. Yeah, it's terrible for a film.
Terrible for a film.
Where it stood out to me as kind of the most like, oh, everyone gets one of these, huh? Is when Max von Sydow's character, Dr. Kynes, the camera kind of zooms in on him and he thinks like, oh, Paul is the chosen one. And I was like, okay, yeah. What, now everyone gets one?
He will know your ways as if born to them. It's it's so good. Dr. Kynes is a huge fucking deal in the book also.
I mean, both films minimize
that role.
He's great in this movie. But yeah, he is only in one scene. This movie is kind of, Justin, as you're alluding to, we can't really go through the whole cast because everyone's in this movie. There's so many people in this movie.
So yeah, there's a part of me that's like, it's like, because I kind of do want to touch a little, like, based on some, like, I will just say here as I put a pin on it, Duncan Idaho is a blip to me. In this film.
Right.
And that's it. That's all I can say. Richard Jordan is as Duncan Idaho is a literal blip.
He's definitely in the movie.
And it very much because of the strangeness of like, okay, how old is Paul supposed to be? I was like, is Duncan his peer or is he supposed to be older?
Yeah.
He is supposed to be older. He's his basic training master, like he's the sword master who trains Paul until he goes away, and then Gurney takes over.
Yeah, and it's same with Gurney, like Patrick Stewart, you know, I will mention that he's in the film, but he actually doesn't really have a ton to do in this film.
He's a better Gurney. Gurney.
Okay, wow. We're gonna put a pin on that until we get to the 2021 film. So I'm gonna go...
And also, wasn't the rumor that Patrick Stewart was not the actor they wanted? They wanted another actor who was also named Patrick Stewart, but they accidentally cut this
one. I want that to be true so bad. I want that to be true so bad.
I don't remember where I read that, but it definitely, I was like, yeah, that makes sense somehow.
It's just like he comes on set and Lynch is like, oh no. So I'm going to go straight to another character of importance that I feel like there'll be a good compare and contrast discussion, and it is Kenneth McMillan as Baron Vladimir Harkonnen.
Oh, yeah.
The Power Rangers villain version. Yes. here's the deal. I love his performance. Like, clearly he did as directed.
Right.
I think he is fucking entertaining. I think he's gross and terrifying. Mm-hmm. He did everything he was supposed to do. It's just, you know, Lynch had them crank that shit up to 12.
Right.
And we just had to sit there and watch it.
Yeah, his opening moment is there's a doctor picking at a face scab of his.
Yes.
And then that leads into, we find out that he is able to fly. So it's kind of...
Yeah. The suspensors are a problem. That's one of my biggest gripes about that movie. So this is more nerd book talk. So the suspensors, the idea is the Baron is actually so obese, and there are reasons. There's actually a backstory. He didn't used to be, and it's not just an eating habit. He was punished. And so his body is so large, he requires suspensors to carry most of his weight so that he can walk around. Mm-hmm. And in this case, it's like, actually, I think the Dune version did a better job of how the suspensors are described in the book as being those, like, that strap system. But he really doesn't really, like, float. Like, he just lightly touches the ground. However, in the event of his escape, he has to fly away. Then that is a thing. That does happen in the book. So I think both films made a point of being like, look how mobile he is, so that it makes sense that he gets away from the gas cloud. So that's more of like a visual reasoning thing. But the fucking front flips, that was too much for me. God. It's like a bad Peter Pan production.
I will say the Harkonnens in the Lynch film are by far the most Lynchian element to me. They mm-hmm. to me scream like these are the characters that David kind of for some reason understands the most how to portray.
Oh yeah.
And I might even go as far as to say like I kind of prefer the grossness of them here. But
yeah,
because I think there's something kind of interesting and appalling about them that makes me go, ooh, no, could someone stop these guys?
they accurately portray the Baron's kind of rapiness in the 84 Dune. Like, because they still make him gross in the new one, but in this one he really is that bad. Like, he is fucking awful. Mm-hmm. He is a terrible human being. And they kind of make him just like, I am bad in the new one. And this, anyway. But Piter is also way better in this film. I'm also a huge Brad Dourif fan, and he nails it. Actually, I don't know. I feel like the new guy, gosh, what's his name? Polka Dot Man.
You're right. I can pull out his name really quick. Hold on. But you're right.
It's
he did play David
Dalmachian.
David Dalmachian?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I feel like he was perfect casting, and they cut down his part mm-hmm. because Piter is this weird, twisted mentat guy, and I love the humor that Brad Dourif brought to it, because he really is fun. He's one of the few people who enjoys his time being alive in the books and in the movie. Anyway.
Go ahead.
I want to bring up a character that is not in the new one. And I want to bring up this character and actor.
I was gonna bring this up too. So all right,
see what we all have to say about this. The human known as Sting,
yes,
is Fade,
yes,
who is somehow a Harkonnen.
somehow,
yeah. And it's kind of like Fade's whole thing is he wants to kill an Atreides. He wants to kill Paul. And he can't stop saying it or thinking about it.
they did, yeah. They made him pretty one note. So Fade is. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
All I can say is I love the idea of like he is supposed to be. He's like the anti-Paul. I kind of love that. But having Sting do it was kind of like, oh, okay. What happened here?
It's so fascinating because it's like I don't want to get too far into our Patreon stuff we'll talk about, but I mean, Andrew, I know we totally don't talk about the Patreon too much, but I'll say in the Patreon of our episode of Dune, there's a casting for Fade that I'm just going, what is it about rock stars? Which I get, to a certain degree, that people feel like, yeah, that's someone who should play Fade, which I guess I sort of understand. And so I'm curious, is like, part two hasn't even started filming yet, and I guess I'll put my thoughts on that, you know, not too much on that, but I am thinking, like, they're going to start filming part two for the 2021 one soon, and I'm like, who are you going to get? You know, like, who will be, like, the 2022 version of Fade that you will cast in that? That's fascinating to me. Sting's all right in this. He does a lot of acting with his eyes. I'm not sure if it's good acting, but you know his eyes are very wide in this movie. Speaking of rock stars, though, I'm going to transition this to talking about a thing that I've been mildly obsessed with since watching this film. The music by Toto and Brian Eno.
Hell yeah. God, so good. I love that score.
Da, 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 da. Da, 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 da. Like, oh, this is my jam.
It's so good.
And it's funny because you hear Toto you know, you don't really think this kind of movie, you know?
Right.
And I feel like it's funny because I'm watching them and, like, yeah, I know Brian Eno is a big part of the score too, but, like, there's this bit when they finally start riding the sandworms and then the guitar starts coming in. My brain's like, mm-hmm. There you are, Toto. There's the Roxanne singing group that I know. anything you guys want to add about the score? Because I kind of fucking love it.
I mean, it follows me around my whole life. It lives in the back of my brain. But yeah, I don't think it's terrible. I think it actually complements the movie well.
I agree.
I still might like it more than new score. Mm-hmm. Because it feels like it's got themes. It's got music.
Sure.
I have opinions.
Well, I feel like that's sadly a modern movie problem in general.
Yeah.
Is their fear is like either the filmmakers or the studio has a fear for themes, which I don't know why, because I'm like, that's my favorite part of a movie score.
Honestly, as much as themes can be risky, I think especially when I talk about the Gal Gadot Wonder Woman series, her theme is kind of the best thing that came out of it. It's kind of
yeah. I can hum it. That's the key thing. I can hum it.
And it's like if you played it a little bit in the score, I would start getting excited. Like I would know she's around the corner. She's gonna start kicking ass. It's gonna be great.
Well, it's the same with me and Captain America. Like that's the only one where I can like bum 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 bum. Like I go, oh, Captain America's on his way. And so yeah, here I think of the bah, 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 da. I'm like, oh, dude, nice.
There's two things I want to make sure that we get in when talking about the 84 Dune. The weirding modules.
Fuck. Fuck. I hate them so much. They're so stupid. God.
Oh my God. Please go into that. Why?
Sure. Okay. So here's the deal. The weirding way in the book is essentially like it's Bene Gesserit Kung Fu. The idea is they're able to move faster, like at a rate that the eye cannot record. Mm-hmm. So it's like, think of like changing your frame rate on like a light or something where you can't see the blinking anymore. That's how fast they're moving.
Right.
And they like, you know, they'll jump around. They'll fucking overtake you. Same thing that it's basically what Jessica and Paul did to the Fremen in the desert to earn their keep. And so that's the weirding way. That's all it is. And then they also have the voice, right? As well as a few other tricks that the Bene Gesserit have. But that's all it's supposed to be. So then for whatever reason, and maybe it's just because they didn't want to do more sword fighting in the desert, Lynch decides the way to go is barking into a box and having it crack stone for some fucking unknown reason.
My name can kill people.
So my name is a killing word is an actual line from the book, but that's not at all what the fuck that means. Like that, it's so the meaning behind the my name is a killing word is he becomes this, you know, religious icon who leads a jihad across the entire fucking known universe.
Right.
And that's what that means. It's like if you say my name somewhere, people are gonna, you know, it's overflow boil, they're gonna, you know, they're going to go and have religious wars. That's what that means.
Ooh.
I mean, but also he has mastery over the voice by the end of the film and also in the book. So he can control people, but he can't literally be like Muad'Dib and then fucking so stupid. That's one of the things that just I my brain turns off when that part happens and I just have to deal with it.
And then the other thing that I want to mention is the shields that are cubes.
Yeah. I thought that was fine. I mean, they did what they could at the time.
It definitely felt like this is the best they could. This is the best they could visualize in 1984, and I understood what they were going for. It is a little like clunky in the way that like it doesn't really come off really exciting overall. Like it's a neat visual for 2.5 seconds, and then when you get into further into the action, it's like. It is kind of hard to see though, ain't it? Like,
The whole concept also about fighting in this universe is a little like anti-movie because the only way you land a strike is by going slower and more controlled, which nobody wants to see on screen, right? You don't want to see people like I slow stabbed you so good.
I kind of love that phrase anti-movie, which you know that I think. as I'm seeing more adaptation or learning more about the adaptations of the source material, my brain is like, I see why you all want to make it a movie, but it seems the book almost, it's not, the book wasn't consciously doing this, but the book was like, but I'm a book though.
It basically screams that every few pages. You're like, what the fuck? If they ever make it to the fourth book, I'm just gonna buy tickets for everyone. I'm very excited. They're not gonna do it, but that one's an acid trip. That one is bonkers as hell, and I'll tell you nothing. Just, if you get there. It's worth the ride.
That's exciting. I mean, as far as I can tell, it is kind of like generational, right? So like,
yes.
Yeah, Danny, you were kind of hinting that if they do continue the story, they will have to recast some people.
Yes.
Just because.
Yeah, I mean, the first two should be fine. So, like, if they do Dune Messiah, which it seems like, I can't say his name, Villeneuve?
Villeneuve? Yeah.
So he wants to make at least a second one. And I think he could do that with the next cast. It would just, because it happens a few years later. So they're like adults. But everybody else could probably stay the same. Mm-hmm. So either they age them up with makeup or maybe recast a few people. But if they go to three, they will absolutely have to recast everybody.
Okay.
Unless he waits, you know, half a lifetime.
Yeah. Okay. That's fair.
I didn't love this movie.
Fair.
Yeah. I think that's kind of my only way to get at it, is that it kind of, a lot happens. Like, Justin, like you were saying, it kind of, goes very quickly once it hits a certain point. It's just kind of like, oh, and then there's this, and there's this, and then we get to the end, and the end is almost bizarre. But it does end with Paul and Fade fighting.
Yes, yes. Good stuff.
We have to end with a duel.
But Danny, why do you hate the ending so much?
The rain. The rain. It does not rain on Arrakis. It undermines the entire subplot of fucking Dr. Kynes. Like, everything about that is wrong and awful and terrible. Like, it's like, here's a fucking Cinderella happy ending for this story that has no happy endings. There are no heroes. No one is good. Like, and they're just like, just kidding, Paul saved us all. Like, no, he didn't. No, he did not.
I also just imagine, you know, the flooding that would occur with all that rain just hitting a desert planet. Like, deserts are not prepared for water.
No.
Well, but then, yeah, that's the other thing. Is like, there's so much information. As much as they were able to cram into that film, there are answers to that, because all the water isn't gone. It's being, you know, carefully stowed and taken care of by the Fremen. Mm-hmm. Not that it isn't a desert planet and they're not having to be sparing with it, but there are secret holding areas for waters. Various sieges and all that stuff. It's a whole thing. And then there's a whole terraforming subplot, which is why Dr. Kynes is so important. And it's like, you know, you can only touch on so much, because you can only fill 5 hours if you're David Lynch, but like, you know, 2.5 if you're a normal human. So much.
Okay. And there is so much. we'll clearly touch more. I feel like we're going to touch back more on this film even more when we talk even about the 2021 film. But we are going to take a quick short break. We'll get right back to Arrakis right after this.
To all who come to this happy podcast, welcome.
And amusings are your musings.
Here age relives fond memories of the past.
And here youth may savor the challenge and promise of the future.
Hi, I'm David.
And I'm Kayla.
And if it wasn't readily apparent from that, we're huge nerds about Disney. That's why we're doing the Animusings podcast.
Once a month, we'll sit down and talk about a film in detail from the Walt Disney Animation Studios filmography, covering them in chronological order, from Snow White to Moana and beyond.
To Moana and beyond!
Sweetie, we're not doing Pixar yet. We'll do that after.
That's gonna be a long time coming. Anyway, if that sounds up your alley, come join Kayla and I, and maybe a guest or two, as we explore the Disney animated canon, film by film.
With the hope that it'll be a source of joy and inspiration to all the world.
Ooh, nicely said.
Don't thank me. Thank Walt.
Before we get back into the spice, where we're just rolling around in that spice, turning our eyes blue like crazy, I wanted to talk about our Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/nothingnew, you will find a whole bunch of bonus episodes that you can subscribe to, starting at just $1 a month. Anything helps. And I wanted to give you a little preview of our episode for this month, and you're going to hear that right now.
Because he does have entitlement. I want that to be so obviously clear. You made two films. You made two films that people have loved at this point, and you were given $1 million to make a film like A Holy Mountain, which is, you know, that's still a lot of money to this day to make a film like the one you made. And so for me, as a person who's all the film, any personal work I do it for zero money. You know, it's favors. It's asking friends to perform in this thing for a day without being paid, other than maybe a lunch. All right, so once again, as little as $1 a month, you get an extra episode, sometimes relating to the main episode that's available for free. But a lot of times you get a lot of original episodes that are just specifically for the Patreon, and we, once again, I want to keep stressing, we have at the moment no plans to put the Patreon episodes in any other place, so you can only get them on our Patreon. And like I said, kind of like I was hinting at earlier, there is no guarantee we'll do part two of Dune. So if you do want to hear us talk about Dune part two, I don't know what we'll do about the remake half, but if you really want us to talk about the original half, but we'll really talk about, if you really want to hear us talk about part two, there is that extra incentive, and we will gladly gladly cover part two. So that's one way to get us talking about it, guaranteeing us on part two.
Yeah, our Patreon at $25 a month. You just have to do it for 1 month, and you get to tell us what you want us to cover.
Yeah, it's $25 for just say talk about this. So it's like, I want to hear your thoughts on part two when it's 2023. We're like, all right, you gave us $25.
It was Ken had us talk about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yeah,
which was delightful.
Yeah, the 2014 version and then the 1990 or 1989 version. So,
let's also say we've started streaming on Twitch.
Right. We have.
What's the Twitch called, Justin?
Well, at the moment, it's just going to be under... We don't have a Nothing New Twitch account, so we're just streaming under my personal Twitch account, which is twitch.tv/JustinKeysOn. And just follow us on Nothing New. We'll let you know when our next Twitch stream will be. We're only going to do these maybe like once a month. And they get... Once again, they will also pertain to the film we're talking about that month, so... when we did Psycho in October, to give you an idea of what's the full package, the main episode was the original Psycho film and then the Gus Van Sant remake. On Patreon, we talked about Bates Motel, the A&E TV series, and then on our live Twitch stream, which actually a good amount of you did show up, and I really appreciated that.
We really do.
Yeah. And kept the discussion going, which was great. We talked about Psychos 2, 3, and 4 on our live Twitch stream. So, and many of you didn't even know there was a Psycho 2, 3, and 4. So, we won't reveal quite yet what the Patreon will be for... I'm not Patreon, what the Twitch stream will be going with Dune. So you just have to follow us on our social media account, or specifically Instagram account, and you'll find out from there. But before we go on with that, Danny, please tell folks where they could find you and the amazing projects you guys do over at Perception Studio.
Sure. Hi, everybody. Danny Montooth here. You can always find me individually at dmontooth on Instagram or Danny Montooth on Twitter, because somebody beat me to it. But collectively, you can find our company at Percept Studio on Insta and Twitter, because also, again, dumb, Perception Studio is too long to fit. So it's Percept Studio everywhere. But generally, all of our shows are going to be on twitch.tv/Perception Studio. So for me, I'm a co-founder of the company, like a producer, a performer, but at the company we also make, we design and fabricate puppet characters for other people. The majority of us are puppeteers or voice actors and stuff like that. I also narrate audiobooks. You can find me on Audible, I do a lot of things that I'm interested in, and I think that lots of people should do the same. But that's pretty much me in a nutshell.
I get that. Trust me. I respect that. Okay. So, we're now in 2021. Before that, I have mentioned and alluded to a couple times, there was a Sci-Fi Channel miniseries that came out in 2000. And they also did an adaptation of Children of Dune.
Yes.
We're not going to go too hard into that, but I am curious. Danny, have you seen these adaptations?
I have, but I barely remember them. I remember they were pretty close, like story-wise. It's like they were fine, but it's like you could tell they suffered from low budget and a few other things, and chemistry was weird with some of the actors. But it wasn't awful, but I don't know if they needed to be made in that way.
Yeah, probably a little before the time they can handle such a big concept as Dune to do a TV thing. Like, I know William Hurt played Leto Atreides. That's interesting. And a baby James McAvoy was in Children of Dune. my memories of the Sci-Fi Channel version was it looks like, wow, you guys really did definitely shoot the desert planet on a soundstage.
And the butterfly outfit and a whole other stuff. Like, the costuming is weird. Like, it's sure, why not? But I feel like it's very much like, let's try to be weirder than Lynch. It seemed like the goal.
Yeah, that's a fair assessment. On a budget of $20. Let's do this. So yeah, we not too much talk here about that version of Dune. Just want to let you know, I'm acknowledging it. Now we're gonna move on. So so Dune as a feature, though, as a new attempt at trying to make this movie, a new adaptation of Dune has went through, it just seems like this is just seems to be the fate of Dune, a laundry list of filmmakers. And I think I've heard it feel, I feel like I heard a different person attached to an adaptation of Dune like every 5 or 6 years. I feel like the earliest one, the one that seemed like that was kind of maybe about to maybe start something was in 2008, where Peter Berg was set to direct Dune. And then he left like a year later, and then Pierre Morel, who finished making a lot of money with Taken. the beginning of Liam Neeson's old man action movie career. he was signed on to do Dune after Berg left to do other projects. So it looks like he was pretty close to doing it for maybe about a year or two, and then he left. And so then Dune kind of just floated about in Paramount, and then they lost the rights. Then it was around 2016, Legendary Entertainment acquired the rights to do Dune, and that's when Denis Villeneuve was set to direct in 2016. And it was interesting that it would be Villeneuve, because at the time, it looks like he just finished making Blade Runner 2049. Folks haven't even seen it yet. Arrival did come out, so people knew that he had an interest in science fiction, but also he was kind of known for doing more like heavy drama before Arrival. So, you know, I forgot his Hugh Jackman film at the moment, but I forgot his other two films before his science fiction stuff.
He did Prisoners, right?
Thank you, Prisoners.
And then he did, what was that one? Did he do
Sicario? He did Sicario. And no one talks about this movie between Prisoners and Sicario, but he did a film called Enemy with Jake Gyllenhaal. But yeah, he was known for these kind of movies. And so it looks like with Arrival and Blade Runner 2049, he seemed like he was like kind of showcasing, hey, I like science fiction as well.
Justin, you're revealing that I might have seen every single one of his English language films. I didn't realize this until you're bringing this all up, but
I think I've seen none. I think this might be my first movie that he's made that I've seen.
Wow,
interesting. Okay, yeah. I will recommend Arrival and Blade Runner 2049, mm-hmm. personally. I think those are pretty good.
I think also a thing that I believe I read was that he did Arrival and Blade Runner 2049 as kind of ramping himself up to show that he can do Dune.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of like he hadn't done a sci-fi film and he didn't want to have Dune be his first sci-fi film.
I would definitely not make Dune. I think Lynch would be the first one to tell him, don't make Dune your first sci-fi movie.
But yeah, I think that is so interesting. Because I would say that I am a pretty big fan of his. All the way back to Prisoners, which is a very, you know, dramatic, you know, down-to-earth story about what happens when there's a child is kidnapped.
Mm-hmm.
All the way through, I mean, Sicario even has such a strange structure to it about, you know, how the government responds to, like, drug trafficking and stuff like that. He really makes very interesting and complex movies about weird and not always likable characters.
That seems like the kind of guy who should probably be doing Dune.
Yeah, it kind of feels like that's a good fit.
Mm-hmm.
Everything worked out this time.
It did. I'm glad I don't live in the world where we saw the Dune film directed by the guy who directed Taken. No offense, I like Taken, but yeah. I don't think that's the... I'm glad we don't live in that world. Yeah. Like, there's a whole documentary. There's a whole documentary about another guy who could have made that movie, and I'm also
glad that one didn't happen.
Yeah, again,
yeah, Jodorowsky's Dune would have been a fucking wreck. It would have been awesome as an art house film. Like, would probably buy it, love it, watch it a million times, but it wouldn't be a Dune movie. Like, there's no way in hell.
And I'm glad we got your point on that. That is our Patreon episode. So, is that documentary. So I'll hold our thoughts on that till you have to. Sorry, you have to pay for that. But but I will say that, like, it does seem like of all the things I had to go wrap up, like, you know, Peter Berg, which I also think that would have been a bad fit. I'm kind of glad that Vindaloo came out and I started, you know, I've seen Arrival and Blade Runner 2049, and each of those movies kept coming out and I was watching that one. I don't know, I'm feeling pretty good about this guy as a choice. You know, these are pretty heady concepts of sci-fi, and with Blade Runner 2049, he showed he can paint on a bigger scope, you know, and so I was very curious to get into and hoping that he could pull something off with Dune, but also I Dune's got this sort of weird rep as being kind of hard to get into for everyone else, so I was very curious, like, is this the Dune that'll finally make, like, an impact with non-sci-fi audiences? So that was something that I was intrigued by when I finally got around to watching it. So I'm curious here. Go ahead, Andrew, go.
No, I want to bring up one point. So, you know, this is going to sound like I'm not the movie lover that I am. I watched this Dune at home. I watched it on HBO Max. I did not go to the theaters to watch this.
Mm-hmm.
And I would assume, Justin, I had heard that you went. Danny, did you go to a theater to watch the new Dune?
Yeah, I went to see it in the Dolby, whatever the heck it's called.
Yeah. Thing. Now, yes. I had, you know, I knew it was Dune, but when you see it on screen on HBO Max, it comes up Dune Part 1.
Right.
Is that how it showed in theaters as well? Because I think that is kind of a weird marketing thing where they don't want to put it on the poster that it's Dune Part 1, because then everyone kind of groans. They go, oh, great. Oh, we gotta go. We know that this one's gonna be, you know, a never ending story again. It's gonna be another Marvel situation where we gotta come back every time and see what's going on in the next installment.
Right.
But by calling it just Dune, they're able to be like, oh yeah, come see this totally normal movie that's not setting up a sequel.
Gotcha.
Yeah. It really. And then as soon as the title pops up, it's like Dune Part 1, and I'm like, oh, they said it. They said it right here.
And this was interesting because that's the opposite of what they did with It.
Yeah.
Where It started and then it ends with It Part 1.
Will return. So, yeah, in Part 2.
I almost feel like what might have happened here is a case of, like, now we are in a weird place with these big, you know, franchise movies that the audiences are actually kind of expected that it's going to be a beginning of something. So I feel like they're now, like, going, we don't have to hide. This is the part one. Buckle up.
This is also one of those rare movies where it's a benefit to be able to cut it up. Unlike others where it's like they're just milking a cow, you know, like right. The Hobbit,
you know, a great example. Yeah.
Yeah. Hobbit should have been one film and it would have been, not perfect. It would have been probably still deeply flawed if it in any way resembled those movies. But I think that, this one, it's like it needs it in order to breathe, in order to actually let this story unfold in a way that is entertaining and thought provoking. Like you need the time. And I'm very glad they cut this one up. Like, and I'm also glad they're not cutting up the second one, what will be the third movie, but the story from the second book. They want to do that in one.
Right.
Because they're smart. They're just like, this is what we need to tell it. And I do like that studios are willing to trust creators to do that now, to like gamble on it a little bit. But this one, like part two wasn't greenlit until after it, you know, pulled in all those international numbers. So it was a total bet on the director's part.
That's kind of a wild thing, right? Like, I don't want to go far into that too much, but the idea that, like, you know, it's not like a Lord of the Rings situation where they filmed the majority of the films in one go. They were like, look, this franchise has sort of had a history of kind of not doing well. So, you're gonna have to make your film. You're gonna make your movie, but we can't guarantee you another one because who knows if people will watch the first one, which is a big gamble, like you said, because this film does end on a, and there's more to come.
Oh god, yeah, character an eye roll of a line too. Yeah. Okay.
Only the beginning.
Thank you. Yes, thank you.
So let's go into
Well, I also want to talk about there's something very interesting that happens in this film where we start in a completely different perspective. And I feel like part of that is kind of recognizing the current, you know, way the world is with the kind of way that everyone has awareness of, like, oh, it's bad when someone takes over a planet. Like, there's like this, oh right, they're colonizers, these are not, you know, good people. And so we open, this dune opens with Zendaya as she's Chani, right?
Chani, yeah.
And she is narrating and saying, like, the Harkonnens are leaving our planet, but we know it's not gonna last long, they're horrible people, we hate them. Like, it's kind of like, oh, we are completely changing the point of view of how we're going to get into this story, which I think is fascinating.
Oh, I agree. Yeah, I love, like, this line. I mean, invented for this. All of her narration is invented for this. But the like, I wonder who our next oppressors will be. And I was like, hell yeah! Oh yeah! Like, that was the second I knew. I was like, the guy who makes this understands the book. Like I'm fucking in. Like, I 100% in after that. Yeah, so good. And I also think the change for that also makes it more immediate, right? So that thing that we were talking about earlier, which was, you know, what works for the book, is like, hey, we're going to tell you what's going to happen, now watch it unfold. We don't get that in the film. We get, this is what's happening right now. Mm-hmm. So that way it's like, you don't know how it's going to end. So if you're coming into Dune for the first time, you're not being told the ending of the film in the first 10 pages. You know, they're letting it unfold in a natural way, which I think is also really smart.
Yeah, no, I agree. And it's funny, it's, you know, like I said, as much as I appreciate some of the big swings that Lynch does visually in the 84 film, I do like that we get to, you know, pace ourselves in this one and get to know everyone a lot better here. I think to me, the strength of getting a guy like Ventilue is letting him let the characters breathe and kind of have moments to kind of understand them between the big set pieces and the spaceships and the sandworms and etc.
Justin, I 100% agree. I was like, this is so interesting to have a new version that pays such close attention to the personal connections between these characters. We're not just zoomed out and going, look at the Shakespearean drama. We're getting in close and we're going, okay, you know, what? Why does Jessica love her son? What what does Oscar Isaac do to show that he cares about his people? Like, there are there are these little moments where I'm like, yeah, this one has, like, heart somehow. Like, more heart than the Lynch version, which kind of, it was almost clinical in a way.
It's not super, like, it's not super, like, in your face about it, too. It's subtle things. Like, there's the shot when they're finally landing on Arrakis, door opens up, you see very quickly, like, Leto and Jessica are holding hands before the door opens. And to me, that's like, oh, that shows their intimacy, as, you know, that's showcasing their own personal love and intimacy in a very quick way, and they're still kind of keeping it a little bit on the quiet side, you know, because that's not how other people look at their relationship, but they care for each other like that. To me, like, oh, look at that, that's simple. But I didn't, you know, that's simple and you get the point right away, you know. It's the way how Chalamet and Momoa have a pretty strong chemistry that I understood their relationship very quickly in their first scene together, whereas I didn't understand, like, to counteract what you said about Duncan and Paul's one scene in 84, you didn't know where they where they were coming from. Here it's, you know, big brother Duncan, little brother Paul. That's essentially the small version of it. And I buy it, you know. And like, even like this bit where Paul's like, oh, I'm going to go with you. And Duncan's like, nope.
and even that little, like, he's like, I dreamed that you died. And if I'm there, I can stop it. And it's like, wow, that's like, there's so much emotion in just that line. Like, it's, you really get what's happening between these characters just with that. It's like, wow, that really, they really opened up more than Lynch ever dared.
And I think they did an excellent job in this film of telling you everything that you need to know and letting you either fill in the blanks or ask the questions to fill them in yourself. Like, they didn't bog you down with information, but you don't walk away feeling like, I don't know what's happening.
That's a key thing, Danny. And I wanted to actually ask you that specifically, because I didn't feel like, I didn't rewatch the Lynch film first. I actually decided I'm just going to get to 2021 first so I can let that be my reintroduction to the world. And I did not feel lost, even though it's a lot to take in. How do you, like, what do you think they did right here as opposed to what maybe kind of David Lynch and his crew had a harder time figuring out and doing the same thing?
Trusting the actors and doing a more efficient job of telling a visual story. I think that there is, like, you're talking about all those micro moments between these characters, like these little flicks of eye contact and stuff like that. For people who've read the book, you literally know the words that they are thinking, and the actors are portraying those thoughts on the screen, 100%. So it's like you still pick up on those things subconsciously, even if you don't necessarily know, like, the exchange that's happening. And also same thing, like, you know, constantly, like, hammering in the symbolism of, like, you know, the matador and the bull and doing all this, like, all this other shit, just like, and it's all, he does a great job of taking the set dressing of the book and making it the story of this film, and not just set dressing, but people, interactions, all of it. There are a few things that I think are absolutely missing, which make it a little more two-dimensional, but again, like, I can't fault him for it because he's trying to make it cohesive and understandable and digestible, and it just would have bogged it down. So, like, every single time I'm like, well, if they added that, it would have been better. I'm like, no, I would have been more satisfied as a book nerd, but not as a film goer.
I actually did watch the 84 version first because I wanted to kind of go on the journey of, like, what, how did people come to see Dune first and then now seeing the new Dune. And it was very interesting to me the way that this movie doesn't start with a lot of information, because the 84 Dune basically tells you things twice. there's like narration, and then there's a character hears it, and it's like, oh okay, I guess we need to know this. This is important. But in this version, it is kind of less said, but even like some of the one like gripe that I had was like I kind of think the Mentats are cool, and I was like we didn't talk about them enough in this version. But it's also
they never said the word.
They didn't even say the word, and I was just like, but then I at the end of it, I'm like, would that have really benefited it? Not really. Like, it doesn't need that. But I
have a counterpoint to that, because actually Mentats are very important, because Paul is one, and they don't talk about it in this movie. He's being trained by Thufir to be one.
Oh my god!
And he is one. So that's again like another level of how much is fucking going on in Paul's head. And so that was one of those minor things where I'm like, that's kind of important. Like it's really important. And they just skipped it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I don't even think especially like the structure of the houses, right? We have in this version, we kind of barely see what's going on with the Harkonnens.
Yeah.
But we understand that there is like a similar structure of like there's someone in charge, there's the Duke, but then there's also this kind of guy who like knows things right next to them, which in the Harkonnen house it's played by David Desmalchian. And who's the actor? He's a wonderful character actor. He shows up in things, and I love him so much. For the Atreides house.
Which one?
Wait, he plays Thufir. I can't remember his name.
Yeah,
he's excellent.
Stephen McKinley Henderson.
Yeah, he's great. Yeah.
Oh my god, he's great in everything that I've seen him in, and he plays the Thufir, the Mentat of the Atreides house. And they give him this little moment where he does his little computerize when he's calculating something. And I was, I was like, okay, so that's their way of saying like this guy, he's smart. He can do math really fast or whatever, but they never say Mentat and they never explain that. And I was like, well, for the purpose of this film, it doesn't really lose anything, but that is like one of those weird things where I'm like, oh, they're like, there's more to this world that they're just not even explaining. And then I think I think a lot of people were feeling like they were kind of lied to when they were told that Zendaya is in this movie and she's kind of in like 2 minutes. You know,
she's going to be all over part two.
I know
people are going to be very satisfied.
But it is kind of so bizarre that she shows up in a lot of places. She's in the dreams. You know, she's all over those dreams. She narrates the beginning. She shows up in person at the end. But she's, it's kind of like catch her on the next one.
It's only the beginning.
But I do feel like knowing the 84 film, like seeing it, that's the thing I'm very much looking forward to for part two of Dune, is just going, I can't wait to actually learn Johnny as a real character for really reals. For once.
Yes, I agree. Especially since you have to lean so heavily into her POV, especially how they opened this first movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's going to be, I think it's going to be her kind of watching a lot of these things happening around her. Mm-hmm. I think she's going to be far more central. And I think that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because the problem with adapting this to like a Hollywood audience is everyone's like, oh, Paul's the hero. And he's not really. he is the protagonist, but he's not a hero, and that's sort of like the whole point that Herbert's trying to make with these books is like he has this fabulous quote, and I'm going to misquote him, where it's like, there is no worse fate that can befall a people than a hero, or like than by following or worshiping a hero, something like that. And that's sort of like the thesis of Dune, is it's like all this shit is bad, it doesn't matter how well meaning they are, kind of thing.
And that's gonna be interesting to see what an audience thinks about if they go, hopefully they go there. I would hope they go there for the part two, because I feel like that's gonna really challenge the audience, that challenge the audience and with knowing what they usually assume a character like Paul is gonna be to them in the narrative. Speaking of Paul, how we all feel about Timothée Chalamet as Paul Atreides in this one?
I thought he was great. I think he's a little mumbly, but everybody was, and I feel like that was a direction choice, not necessarily an actor choice.
Yeah, it's a Ventaloo move.
Yeah, but I think he did an excellent job of being just sort of bratty and spoiled enough, but also very tender when he needed to be. I thought he killed it. I think he's an excellent Paul. I think he's going to be awesome in part two.
It's funny because I'm going to brag a tiny bit. So a couple years ago, I interviewed Chalamet for a film he did that's on Netflix called The King. It's not so much my interview with him. He was a great guy to talk to, really easy to talk to. But I will say that, like, The King, I thought about that movie a lot while watching this movie, because in The King, it's like a variation of the King Henry V character as interpreted by Shakespeare, you know. Yeah. And so, yeah, Chalamet plays King Henry, King Henry, and I saw so much of Paul as a character in that movie in a way that I saw, like, oh, I saw why Chalamet got the part as Paul Atreides. It's not just, oh, he's the hot current, you know, young actor, etc. It's that, like, no, he, in The King, very similar kind of concept. He was a young, almost bratty, you know, royalty who got thrust into leadership role, is forced into battle, forced into leadership, and everyone around them has to look at and wonder if this young person can handle, or how they handle being the king of this, etc., etc. And down to even one-on-one battles to prove his worth, which I kind of found very funny watching Dune again, because I was like, oh, I've been here with you with Chalamet. But also, he's pretty good in The King. The movie's fine. It's not amazing, but he's pretty good in The King, and I kind of saw, like I said, like I had a struggle, and I think at the end of the day, you agreed with me, Danny, that, like, McLaughlin is not as great as cheerful Paul. He's all right. But he's great as leader Paul. And I think Chalamet's very good as this part one Paul. But I think he is capable of being the more, you know, the what he becomes and what he will become in part two. I'm very excited to see what it's going to be like to see his transformation as, well, Mos Deep when we get to the Dune part two. Andrew?
Yeah, I can only agree. I think it is interesting to see, you know, a young actor come up and get all of these, you know, go from smaller roles to, like, leading roles, and how they handle that. And I think he handled it very well. I think they're, you know, he made the choices that he had to make to be this character. And I think, yeah, if they continue on in the direction that they should in part two, maybe we'll kind of love to hate him in that way.
I didn't think he's capable of that. Like, if you've seen him in Lady Bird, like, that's kind of a situation similar to there, where his character is like, oh, you find him charming, and then you kind of find this other half, you're like, ooh, screw that guy, you know. And hey, to go into the other, going back again, I want to now talk about, again, still staying with the Atreides family, let's talk about Oscar Isaacs as Leto Atreides.
Oh my god, amazing.
I love Oscar Isaac so much. He can do no wrong, man. He's perfect.
It's like, I'm always good for more Oscar Isaacs. I agree. and I feel like he shares the same elements that you both talked about with Pranchal in the previous film. That's like kind of why you cast him, right? Like, you want him to be all these things, and so when he does, sadly, you know, go, you're gonna have to feel those things as well when he's no longer part of the narrative. And thankfully, you know, since this is a, you know, longer movie, you get to spend more time with him as Leto. I actually really like his scene when he first meets Stilgar.
Oh gosh, yes.
Yeah, I think that one is kind of, this movie has humor in it that maybe you wouldn't expect normally. And some of that humor does come out in that scene, where it's like, oh, you know, if someone spits at you, it's like, oh, is that good or bad? What's going on? And then, you know, Duncan has to step in and be like, thank you for your moisture. Like, they have to make it a whole thing. So it's kind of like, oh, that's kind of great. And the way, I mean, there is kind of like a campy nature to the way that Oscar Isaac says desert power.
Yes. Yeah.
But I think that is like the kind of weird thing where it's like, if you are this person, and like he says, he's like, we've got water power, we got land power, I want desert power. And it's kind of like, you start to believe him and you're like, let's get some desert power.
And both of those things mentioned are straight out of the book too. So it's like, that's like the Stilgar coming in, being an asshole, spitting on the table, all that's straight out of there. Same thing with desert power. Desert power comes up a lot. Like, if anything, they underplayed the use of that ridiculous term in the film. But I'm glad they used it at all. Both times it was said, it was like, yep, that's okay.
Danny, so what's your thoughts on Momoa as Duncan in this version of the film?
He's fine. No, I mean, he's great. Like, this is, I mean, he is perfectly cast because he is that guy. He is that actor. He's that charismatic. All the ladies love him because in the book that's who he is. Duncan mm-hmm. Idaho is just this hot man who goes around kicking ass. Then and that's all you really learn about him in book one.
I mean, that's actually sounds like, yeah. If I read that, I went, you know, so Momoa, we're gonna get Momoa on this one.
So I am sad. So sort of like more things that are omitted that I wish they kept. There's a whole traitor subplot thing that ultimately leads to Yue, right? That they just didn't do. So the whole idea is like they're hunting for this guy the entire time. Who the hell is it? You're trying to figure it out, blah, blah, blah. And then the whole idea of him. Anyway, at some point, there's a part where poor Duncan gets drunk and thinks it's Jessica and spills his guts to her and alerts basically the royals to, hey, we know there's a traitor, things are bad. So then like stress and tension goes like through the roof for these following scenes. Mm. So I feel like he didn't get the chance to play sort of like that other side, that like his, some of his unlikability coming out. I just wanted him to be like the Boromir of this movie, I think.
That's
which is fine.
Totally fair. I can see that. Yeah. 100%. Andrew, is there anything you want to add to that? Or
no, that all checks with me. I think the closest they get to giving him a little more is he does have this kind of, you know, Duncan has this kind of journey in this movie of saying, I'm going to go in, I'm going to find these Fremen, I'm going to straighten them out. And when he gets mm-hmm. there, we find him later. And even, I mean, Gurney says to him, you know, you've gone native, which Gurney is very clearly like, he hates the Fremen. He doesn't even care anything about these desert people. But Duncan has lived with them in a siege. Like, he has, you know, found their ways, you know, and adapted to them. And kind of, he is, you know, doing what Leto wants to do. He wants to harness the desert power. So it's kind of like, I was like, oh, I like that journey for Duncan, but it is kind of understated.
Yeah,
in that way.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Let's unpin this. Why do you not, what is your issue with Josh Brolin as Gurney Halleck?
Okay, so here's the thing. I don't have an issue. I think the parts that we saw I loved, but there's a whole other side to Gurney that we kind of got hinted at, but we didn't get to see. And I know they shot it, which is even more disappointing. In the old one, they do it pretty close to the book where he'll bust out the Balisette and just start playing songs. And they're usually like these body tunes that are super raunchy. And he's got a great sense of humor. Like he guffaws and stuff. Like he has fun. And then this one, they're just like, we're just going to make him the sourpuss and give all the charisma to Duncan, which again, for a film sort of makes sense. But I'm like, man, I wanted to see it. And they had him like, you know, waxing poetic a few times throughout the film, which I thought was great. So again, I don't think that his is bad. I actually really like his Gurney. I think it's fun. And those elements of humanity are there, like him getting kind of like miffed during the fight when he says old man. Like, I love that shit. It's just, it happened on a smaller scale. And like, I wanted more fun Gurney.
Okay. That makes sense. Okay. Lady Jessica, as played by Rebecca Ferguson, what do y'all think?
Oh, good.
Perfect.
Oh, good.
Kind of. This perfect. It's kind of bizarre that for me, watching this movie, I'm like, this is who I'm watching it for. I'm watching it for Rebecca Ferguson. I want to mm-hmm. see her performance. I think, I believe they had said that they wanted to expand her role, Jessica's role in this film. They wanted to make her a little more active. And then even, you know, from an interview that I heard with Rebecca Ferguson on a podcast, she said that was as much, and that she, you know, her character has so many different sides, and like the emotional side, the Bene Gesserit, you know, being a mother, it's, you know, it was, she felt very drawn to this role. And even though I will say she's only 13 years older than Timothy Chalamet,
yes,
you know, she does, they have that great connection. And you know, the later scenes when they're struggling to survive together, it is very much like there is good acting going on between these two very talented actors.
Mm-hmm. Oh, agreed. And that's a wonderful moment. And again, where it's like you get the essence of the book without having to explicitly state it, is the idea that, like, this is the first time that Jessica is seeing her son as an adult, and how quickly he must grow up for them to survive while he's also dealing with all like his visions and spice and all that stuff. So like that tent scene is like the transformation of both of those characters. And I think they nailed that. They did such a good job.
No, I can see that. One thing I definitely kind of want to highlight is, and that's definitely, you know, a thing I really liked is the scene with with her and Leto, where he's kind of saying, like, you know, will you protect him? And she's like, with my life, no, not as, no, I'm not asking you as his mother. I'm asking you, as the Bene Gesserit, will you protect? And I thought that's a really cool way of, like, showing, because I know your dude, I know where you, you know, like, I know where you are emotionally, but will you do this for this other part of you that you, you represent? And I, that to me is, like, the most fascinating element about Lady Jessica as through Ferguson, is that, like, you know, she has two different duties in her head that she has to constantly fight for. And it's even little details too, like after they escape from the ship, and like she's in terms of even running up the dune, you know, sand dunes, she's even ahead of Paul, you know. Like,
yeah,
like I,
yeah,
it's like a small little detail like that, that she's actually even, you know, like she runs faster than Paul, even something like that is to showcase like how much strength she's willing to she has to make sure Paul will be fine. So yeah, no, I think she's I've liked Rebecca Ferguson since I've started seeing her in the Mission Impossible movie, so I definitely feel like she's a, you know, she's quite, like, quite good in this. So comparing from one Baron Harkonnen to another, what is everyone thinking about Skarsgård? Who I like. I'm a fan of Stellan Skarsgård, but what's the thing we're feeling about his
I want to hear version of it. Danny, what did you think of the floating in this one?
So I remember the trailers. I was like, oh, fuck, here we go again, right? And, but I thought they did an excellent job, because he doesn't float high. He doesn't get, you know, dynamic and cartoony about it. And I realized, as the movie was going on, I'm like, that's why they're doing it. And I talked about it at the top, where it's basically, it's like they have to show that he can to make his escape feasible. Mm-hmm. And that is it. And I think every time they utilized it, it made sense, right? It's like when he's flexing, when he's feeling himself, when he's feeling powerful, or when he wants to be imposing. But my favorite, one of my favorite shots in the entire frickin' movie is Leto sprawled out on the chair, him coming across and over the table out of focus, and like his feet scuff the edge before he comes back down. Because that's like the level he should be floating at, right? Where he's just barely above gravity. And it's just so imposing and so fucking terrifying, because Leto can't move, he can't do anything, and this guy's just fucking coming for him.
Mm-hmm.
I would argue I wanted to see him bigger, not gonna lie. I wanted him to be so big that the suspensors were necessary.
Right.
Because it's basically, it's a medical device. Like, it's not just, he's not just, you know, wearing it for fun. and I don't know if that necessarily comes across visually. Mm-hmm. But overall, like, I liked his design. I loved his acting. I think he is more reserved in this film, and I feel like a lot of the shots and the set dressing and the costuming do a little bit more of the work for him in this film, but I think we're going to get more of him as a monster probably in part two.
Danny, this is a question going back to the books. There's a scene where the mother of the Reverend Mother of the Bene Gesserit comes to speak to Baron Harkonnen, and there's like some kind of a spider creature.
Yeah, let's talk about that. What's going on there?
Please.
Is that in the box? Okay. Is that just Jenny Villeneuve going, I can do a weird thing now?
I think it's I can do a weird thing now, but somebody pointed out to me that it might be a nod to some of Geiger's earlier designs for the film that never got made. Art was telling me about that, and I could buy that. I was just kind of like, hey, I respect this. Now, there's a whole ongoing fan theory that this is a Talaxu creation. It has to be, because there are no aliens in Dune. So it's a Talaxu creation, and someone is guessing that it's Wanna, Yue's wife, or these pieces of it are. But I really hate that idea. I don't like it, because I don't think that the Baron would give enough of a shit to do that. He would just kill her. Like, he is a very practical man when it comes to like that sort of business.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that's not true. I hope it's just a weird thing. It's probably a sex toy. Let's be honest. The Baron and his family will fuck anything and anyone. And it's just, I don't know if I liked it.
I definitely.
It was an interesting moment. It got a laugh out of me, but I was like, what the fuck just happened?
I definitely thought it was Yue's wife. And I thought, what a strange direction to go in.
Yeah. Weird, man.
It's funny, like you mentioned. Like, I think that's something that, again, like, what, like, uncomfortably horny is what my friend said when we were watching the David Lynch film concerning the Harkonnens. and I feel like a little, I'm not saying I want, like, the full Lynch Harkonnens, but I mean, there's a part of me that kind of wish Vindaloo added a touch more of that to their portrayal of the Harkonnens. I feel like Vindaloo's a little bit more of a subdued director, so he doesn't go that far. But as I was watching a Lynch film, I was like, I kind of like it, though. Like, in a weird way, just to make you feel more repelled against him. Like, these guys are definitely someone you don't want to be ruling under you, ruling over you. I'm with you both on that. I think Skarsgård overall is, you know, still compelling as the Baron, and I definitely do feel like that creature thing definitely made me go, ah, all right, right, because it Dune, right? You know, like, that's my reaction to that spider human creature. It's like, right, because this is Dune. I don't even know if that's in the book, and you confirmed it kind of wasn't, but it felt like it should be here. I will admit to that.
Yeah, it's not impossible to exist. Like, so the Talaxu are super weird. They make mutant stuff all the time. They've bred, you find out in later books, they bred these things called chair dogs, which are essentially dogs that have been bred to be the shape of chairs that give you, like, living massages when you sit on them.
Oh my God.
It's like, it's not, it's all horrible. So it's like, it's not impossible, but I also just, like, this was unnecessary and weird. But sure, why not?
I actually kind of want to touch a bit on something that you and me are definitely kind of gushing about, the Toto music. I do want to touch into the fact that, you know, this is good old Hans Zimmer doing the music in this film. And I'm kind of with you on, I think I'm going to be with you on this. Like, it's fine.
Yeah.
It's fine.
The crescendo moments are great, but that's the problem. It's like, he's got two settings, which is nothing or reaching in your face, and I wish he would do some fucking melodies sometimes. Like, okay, so the bagpipe bit, that was cool. That was a nice surprise out of nowhere, and
right,
I loved it.
Right.
But even then, it's not much of a theme. Like, you can't go out humming it because you're trying to remember what that that spread of notes was.
Yeah. And
everything else, like it's emotionally impactful, but I want to walk away humming it again. And I feel like this was an opportunity to get you some fucking Lord of the Rings style, like, oh, this is the Harkonnen music, holy shit, or like, you know, we could have a new Imperial March, we could have some shit here that could be so powerful, and it's like he's afraid of it. I'm like, just do it, man.
I'm with you, and it's kind of one of those things where it's, you know, like, we were humming the Wonder Woman theme earlier, and that's I think that's Zimmer, so it's like, clearly you can ask him to do it. So I almost feel like Vindaloo didn't really ask him to go that hard. To which I'm like, nah, man, go that hard. It's Dune. Go ahead. You know, you can do a whole concept album on the ideas of Dune alone, if you so wish. You know, and
many have. They exist. They...
So yeah, have fun. You know, like, but hey, you know, that was the choice, and it's not terrible music. I don't think, you know, obviously Hans Zimmer makes solid to great movie scores, but this is one of those where I went, I kind of wish he went a little more on this.
It's effective, it works, it's just not perfect.
Can we talk about one character who is greatly expanded in this version? Doctor, as they call her, Dr. Light Kynes, played by Sharon Duncan Brewster, who I don't really know from anything, a British actor, it looks like. And I thought she was great. I was like, oh, this is such a good direction to take this character in. Because obviously, you know, Max von Sydow is kind of like, oh, that's a big name. But instead of getting a big name, you just get a very good actor that not a lot of people have heard of. So I feel like those kinds of performances leave a greater impact almost on an audience, because it's like, wait, where has this person been? Why have I not seen them before? I need to seek them out, and I want to see them in everything.
Like, she killed it. She did an excellent job. And I think something that sort of bummed me out is, like, this was one of those opportunities to expand that character even more in a film experience. And we still didn't get enough of Dr. Liet Kynes, because Liet is huge for the Fremen. On second viewing, though, I think they did a good job of at least planting those seeds. So we'll probably get those answers in part two.
Nice.
But we didn't get necessarily her full arc.
Yeah. But I agree. She's fantastic in it. And like, and she does leave a really good, like, impression, for, you know, before, you know, everything happens. Side note, I even will kind of, like, you know, I do kind of like the other hint of the fact that she pulls out these two kind of, you know, like, kind of tools while calling on a sandworm, and my brain's like, oh, right! That's what they do! And it's great that even if you're just sort of vaguely familiar with Dune, you know that they eventually will ride sandworms. And it's kind of rad, and this movie, it denies you that immediately. So you don't know, if you don't know at all, you're going to be like, what was she going to do? But if you do know, you're like, oh, fuck. Hell yeah. No!
But they, it's weird, because then they do show you at the end of the film, somebody riding the worm.
That's true. That's
true. I was like, ah. Because I liked that, too. I was like, oh, they're not going to give us that. That's awesome. And then they did. I think they're afraid not to.
That's fair. Yeah, it's almost if they kind of, it's like they almost want to tell you, don't worry, someone will. It's going to happen. But, I mean, if you watch, if you make this, if you give us enough money on this one, we will guarantee it. But in case we don't, I almost feel like, let's talk about this ending, this montage-y bit at that happens at the film. I do feel like a lot of those sequences was almost if like Benelou's going, hey, in case I don't.
Yeah, I got that feeling too.
Yeah,
there's very much. There's more. See how much money? How much you want?
I do feel like throughout the film, I didn't like how many dream flashes there were.
Uh oh.
I know.
That does not bode well for the Dune universe and you.
I feel like the, at least in the Lynch version, they made it very clear, like, what the dreams were. And in this version, it kind of felt like it was, like, much like the ending. It was kind of like, we're just throwing everything at you. We're just going to give you every single thing. We're gonna show you someone get stabbed. We're going to show you Zendaya. We're going to show you this. We're going to show you that. And it was just kind of like, I don't know how to feel about all of these. I kind of want just I want to just follow these characters.
Got it. For me, so as nerd fan, I thought that they handled the visions a little bit better in this one for that reason. Okay. The idea that they're sort of open-ended. Like, he knows what's important. He knows this thing will happen, but the circumstances of it, he does not know.
Yeah.
So his prescience, like as it continues to grow, it gets sharper. But even then, he's just sort of like, what's the best option here, and does his best kind of thing. So I like the idea that they're unreliable visions, and they're planting that seed from the start.
Okay.
As opposed to being like, we'll just, you know, the scene that we shot earlier, we'll just splice it in sooner, because that's not how he sees things in the story. Mm-hmm. Like all the stuff with Jameis, holy shit, like that was beautiful to me. It's like, you know, follow me, I'll show you the ways of the desert, and then it's gotta fucking kill him. Like, I was like, God, yes.
I'm with you. Well. That was super cool. Cause I was like, oh, right. Okay, cool. And then you get to that fight and went, wait a minute. Wait, how do we do this? How are we gonna handle this? Cause I didn't know. And I thought that was really exciting and kind of really well done. I'm totally with you on that.
And that actor, holy shit. Like when he thinks that Paul is toying with him, like that rage, oh, it was so good. That fight was one of my highlight of the film.
And I love it. I just like to note, much like the 1984 Dune, we gotta end with a little duel one on one where Paul has to kill somebody. there's like little echoes here from the 84 Dune, even if they don't follow the same plot, and even if this one is somehow like 40 to 50 minutes longer and tells less of the story.
Like Danny, so I want to point out, like, it, when, you know, like when you look at, like, say the 84 film to this, especially now that, again, like we kind of made the joke, the 84 film now, it jumps ahead more than this movie. What elements are you looking forward to that you hope they accomplish better? Is there a specific thing or a scene that you hope they do better when they get to part two that they failed in part in the Lynch version?
Yeah. Oh man. All right. I got to think on that. One for instance, something that they actually really sincerely hope that they do. So I feel like that this version ended either a scene too long or a scene too short. So there's a funeral for Jameis, which is a huge fucking deal in the book. Like, that's the real moment where Paul accepts his new role within the Siege, his new names, all that stuff. Like, super, super heavy, important stuff. So I'm hoping the new movie opens with that.
Mm-hmm.
And the impact of that is sort of like every step he takes towards a certain path locks him into his path. And he doesn't want to. So that's something that I hope that they nail kind of in the movie, in this version of the movie, that he's doing it because he has to, not because he wants to. And I don't believe 84 ever really picked up on that subtlety. Mm. It's just kind of like, I am great leader now. Everything I say is gold because I can see the future, which is not completely accurate. I want that conflict, like that conflict in him every time he makes a choice, because every choice he makes is doomed in one way or the other. And I like, there should be weight to these moments. Stuff with Baron, stuff with, because they're gonna have to jump years in part two as well at some point,
which actually might be to their benefit that they took a long while to get around to this one, because Chalamet was like probably early 20s, he said, when he filmed this Dune. Now he's 25, ironically the same age as McLaughlin, so this actually might be a benefit that they took some time between, so that now Chalamet is a little bit much older than when he initially filmed the film. So yeah, that might help to their benefit.
And so Alia is another character that I want like to be seen done well. Just like another thing that should have happened in the tent, now that I think about it. It's like, you're gonna have a daughter, this is gonna be your name, and you're just like, what the fuck, like it gets weird. So Alia is like, you gotta find a really, really good, very young child actor, and then I hope they don't dub over her like they did in the 80s one.
Right.
He is the Quisit Edoras.
Oh, Jesus fucking no.
I mean, this is a spoilers for things we didn't talk about in a movie that we talked about. Does Alia kill Baron Harkonnen in that way in the book?
Oh, okay. Hell yeah. Yeah, no, she's fucking boss. That's I love great. Alia's, yeah.
Oh, she's, like, that's the thing, right? Like, that's one I was thinking of, where I'm like, when I saw that scene in the 84 film, I went, oh man, I wish you guys nailed the pacing to make that as great as that could have been. Because I see the potential of, like, oh, that's kind of cool. I mean, you blew it, but I kind of, I hope you, like, that's something I hope that with the next film, that since you'll get more time and pacing, you're able to make that moment as cool as it was, as it should have been in that film. So I don't know. That's one of the things I'm looking forward to, you know?
Yeah. Oh, also the lack of the modules, right? Like, looking forward to that. Looking forward to them fighting like beasts and stuff. Like, so Golden Path Vision, didn't really care for the armor. I'm on that camp. Mm. I think that was a little much, considering like they're a minimalist society, and even if going to war, they would do what they do best. Just like, you know, utilize the desert. So that was something I was like, meh.
Mm-hmm. Cool reveal though, when that little helmet comes up and it's him, and it's like, oh shit, that's me.
and weird nerd counter to a complaint that I see all the time is like, why does he look so sleepy when the mask comes up? Because y'all, to do the weirding way properly, you've got to be totally centered and calm, so your face will have this relaxed expression because you're like in the zone kind of thing. So it's a, again, that's how, like, stuff like that. I was like, this is how I know this is made by somebody who gives a shit. Every little shot, I was like, all right.
That's cool.
They also did a much better job in this film of utilizing the Fremen and showing how strong they were. Because they talk about it a lot in 84, but they don't really show it. They're just kind of like there, and then they're his army, and then they go fight, and that's about it. Mm. But, like, watching them ambush that Sardaukar army was straight out of the pages. And it's like, they visually made it work perfectly. Anyway, I gush.
to kind of just overall kind of general thoughts, it's like, it's interesting. I almost feel like with this one, it's like, I think we kind of all, like, from what I can tell from us three, like, you know, the biggest thing that, like, the biggest improvement is giving this one the time to breathe that sadly Lynch just wasn't given the chance to do. You know, I feel like that was the key thing. Like, Venelu, we live in a different era where, like, a guy like Venelu was allowed to say, hey, I want to take my time on this one. And they were like, okay. Like, you don't have to, we don't have to, you know, audiences now watched a Marvel movie that's almost 3 hours long. So now they're like, yeah, I guess they're up for anything now. So go ahead, take your time. Whereas before, you know, you have Dino De Laurentiis probably yelling in David's ear going, no, make it shorter. So I don't know, maybe, you know, that's kind of the biggest benefit, I think, that I, from what I can tell from all three of us, is that, like, oh, this time we're allowed to actually get to know everyone and still slowly absorb everything that's going on in the Frank Herbert world.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really... go ahead.
I was gonna say, I thought of one more thing that I can't wait to see how he specifically does. There's like a moment where Paul really kind of like snaps into his abilities mm-hmm. and is able to see past, present, access past lives, all kinds of cool shit. Like, I want to know how they're going to make that. I want to know how they're going to shoot that.
Nice.
It's going to be gorgeous. Very excited.
Excellent. Yeah.
Yeah, that'll be really fascinating. I think definitely by separating this out, calling this part one, letting it breathe, you know, instead of cramming everything, all the backstory, all of the information about the whole universe into one movie, because I think that's the right way to go, because if they did that, then it would just really be nothing new.
Please rate and review Nothing New, a Remake podcast, on your podcast app.
You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Nothing New Pod.
You can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/nothingnew.
Nothing New, a Remake podcast, is part of the Benview Network.
This podcast is a part of the Benview Network.
You can find this and other podcasts like it at BenviewNetwork.com.